You're listening to Plague Talk, the podcast that owes its existence to COVID-19, where, because we suddenly have a lot more time on our hands and worry on our minds, we talk with anybody who dares about the old normal, the new normal, strategies, epiphanies, hopes, and fears, and what we want normal to look like when and if it's all over. Because who says we have to go back to all the things that were broken and wrong before? Our guest is Jacob Ivan Schmidt. Jacob has been in and out of cages, and more in than out, for most of his life. He has also been an electrician, a son, a brother, president of the highly decorated Toastmasters Club number 2535, and a loyal confidant and friend. Sometimes too loyal, as he is about to tell you. I won't give away much about his story because nobody tells it more straightforwardly nor more eloquently than himself. Though still locked up in Washington State, he is now working tirelessly to make himself and every incarcerated person he can reach their own best resource for reentry and support network for transcending the brutality and conditioning of a system built to demoralize, dehumanize, and deface its subjects, and to practically guarantee their recidivism. Jacob Schmidt.
Welcome to Plague Talk. You're doing remarkable things. Your story and your work will help evolve our penal system and the public perception of it so that it truly becomes a system that assists in correcting and reinvesting the incarcerated as full-fledged citizens. And you deserve recognition and support. Sketch for us, if you will, your early life in relationship to the penal system.
Well, I was born and raised in Anchorage, Alaska, Jack, and I had a pretty difficult upbringing. It took me a lot of years before I realized that all children weren't raised the way that I was. My parents were alcoholic, very violent, and it was just all around difficult. I was in and out of homes and hospitals and stuff from as early as age 6, and probably the most, the saddest part to that whole thing is the consistent contact that I had with law enforcement and other agencies that were supposed to be geared towards helping. And they're all across the board acknowledgement and recognition that I was being abused as a child, but they continued to send me home. So, that I was, growing from, pre-adolescent, at about 11 years old, I was sent to a locked group home in Oregon where I spent 2 years. After that, I moved to California at the age of 13, which was basically just a quick transition right into the incarceration process there in the Bay Area. Typically was in juvenile hall, county boys ranches, 4 group homes, more boys ranches. And then at 15, I was sent to the California Youth Authority, which was, in simple terms, just an immersion into dementia. And at 18, I was in San Quentin. Pretty much since the time I was 15, I've been free 1 year and a day, which is today I'm 46 years old, so it's been over 31 years, and I've got 30 years of that incarcerated. I've been all across the country in federal prison, and I've been in state prison here in Washington and California. And today, my commitment is just to really try to make sure that I'm having a positive impact on the community in here. And I'm just working to try to create opportunities for people in prison to have a positive impact on their community within the walls and fences. And I'm trying to help to create opportunities for us to have a similar positive impact in the community at large once we're released from prison.
Throughout your history of incarcerations, what programs or what measures or even messaging was there to help you develop a healthy non-recidivist toolkit and habits?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I think that the way that I've developed was in spite of my incarceration. There was no, single thing. It was just probably a lifelong internal desire to be better than I was and to have a greater outcome than I was, maybe the arc of my life was destined for from my childhood. I can tell you that over the last 6 or 7 years, probably the program that has impacted me in the best way, in the most meaningful way, was participating in Toastmasters. The positive leadership skills It taught me positive communication skills. And where I had those skills with the commitment, I was able to actually launch my life in a direction that truly most people within prison, particularly with my kind of life history, didn't feel was actually going to be possible. But dare to dream big and dare to do greater things than you can dream, and maybe you'll wake up tomorrow feeling like yesterday was a success.
What is Toastmasters?
Well, Toastmasters International is a program that, it is substantively geared towards teaching you to do public speaking. However, that really is just, that's not the largest part of Toastmasters. When I say that it helps to teach you positive leadership skills and positive communication skills, what place where prisoners, where anybody would potentially benefit more from learning those skills than in prison? And we actually have the most most decorated club in our district. Toastmasters club is Club 2535, and we are the most decorated club in our district here in Washington State. I am one of the past presidents, and I'm very proud to have had the opportunity. Our sponsors raise the money to pay our dues. They do it, and they pay for it for us. They spend over $10,000 a year to pay our dues for the Toastmaster clubs here at Monroe Correctional Complex, and I'm very, very thankful for the work that they do.
So at some point you had an epiphany. You realized that something that you had been doing that was keeping you in the cycle and maybe a way to get out. What was that, and how did that happen?
Oh, that's a really good question, Jack. I wish it was a simple 5-word answer. I was in federal prison in 2013, and it seemed to me that in the big places, in the substantive points, I had really gotten my life together. I'd learned a marketable job skill. I'd learned to be an electrician. I have no drug or alcohol addictions. I have no substance abuse problems. I didn't release from prison under the burden of horrible child support debt, things like that. A lot of the things are very difficult for people to do. I went to Tacoma, Washington to be in federal work release, and, things seemed to be going very well for me. I got the job I applied for. I discovered an absolute love for engaging society on its on its terms, and doing all the responsible things, making sure my bills were paid. I love doing things as simple and oftentimes overlooked as cleaning my own toilet and my own bathtub. Unfortunately, I was still prepared in some regards only because there wasn't, at that time, I think, enough thought being given and being directed towards how the psychology of prison impacts, or rather how it impacts our mental health, our mental state. And what happened for me was I had accidentally taken a prison life concept to the community, which it seemed obvious that there's really no place in the community for prison-type thinking. And the thing that I took was an interpersonal relationship standard. And that standard was, if I have your back, then that means it doesn't matter if you're doing good things or bad things. And unfortunately, I became romantically involved with a woman who was in active drug addiction, opiate. It was the first exposure that I ever had to somebody who was in active addiction. She had two amazing children that I adored. And what happened for me very quickly was that after having spent so much of my life in prison and fielding and learning to live intimately with every negative emotion you can imagine, from just mild frustration to outright rage every moment of every day, all of a sudden I discovered the joy, the true pleasure of love. And not necessarily receiving love, because, even to this day, that still doesn't impact me the same as when I feel an outpouring of love. And I loved loving her. I loved loving those children. And what happened was, it wasn't long before I became a liar for her. It wasn't long before my financial you know, responsibilities became mismanaged because of my relationship with her. And ultimately, in an attempt to try to solve problems, I, you know, finally concluded that, hey, if I just had enough money, I could fix this. And, of course, that's almost the worst thinking that could ever be employed by somebody at any time, but particularly somebody with a history of criminal behavior. So I robbed a bank, and I was caught. And after my arrest, I was so shattered. It was indescribable. It is indescribable. I still, today, have not pulled the pieces together. I have tremendous self-image issues and so much anger directed at myself for putting myself back into this situation. And I remember, Jack, that I could say I cried a thousand tears, and I wouldn't be accurate. I cried millions of tears. And I asked myself over and over again, how and why did this happen? Because in the brief months that I was free, I didn't do drugs. I never touched a gun or a knife or anything. I never had any intentional criminal consideration. And I think this, to be fair, the first 999 times that I asked myself how and why, it was just really out of self-pity, and it was mournful. But finally, somewhere, one of those questions, one of those hows and whys, actually kind of flipped the switch for me. And I realized that, hey, wait a second, there's actually some answers here, which in a sense gives my life purpose and meaning today, because it is what drives my work, my everyday commitment and focus. And what I realized was I had accidentally taken a prison standard to the community, because I should have left a relationship when I became a liar to everybody else in this world for that person, because that person was doing drugs, right? Mm-hmm. Not just that person had a problem, but active addiction necessitates felonious behavior. The purchasing and the having of narcotics that are a felony, which I should never subject myself to being around. And then the gradual dismantling of my own sense of self-worth that happened as being part of this relationship. And so today, I realized, hey, wait a second, we need to work within prison as a community of peers to identify the antisocial norms. And some of them are very obvious, Jack. I mean, it's clear that if somebody bumps into you in the grocery store line, don't turn and punch them based upon some bizarre prison standard of respect. Many of these antisocial norms are so much more difficult to discern and to identify, and probably that much more insidious because of it. And that's what we work for today, is to try to help people raise their awareness of what these antisocial norms are, and then to plant them with pro-social ones prior to their release from prison.
Because let me ask you a question, because without that kind of assisted awareness, that kind of assisted awakening, or whatever you want to call it, retraining of the mind, how could you, if you've been in institutions most of your life since you were 11, how could you bring anything but, I mean, unless you had a situation where people both taught, provided you with an example, provided you in an environment where it makes sense to live the example, and provided you with the messaging that you were good enough and capable of doing it, which are not things, to my understanding, that generally happen when you're incarcerated. But unless you have that, how can you bring anything but the prison standard that saves your life when you're in prison back to society?
I don't know that there is.
It'd be a miracle.
Well, you're right. And it wouldn't be, what it would be an extremely unlikely, you know, development. And it would be an accident. And maybe, you know, that is justification for me to be a little bit more gentle with myself. But, you know, I had spent a lot of years. I'd spent 14 years in federal prison. And I had long before my release, I had committed to being a good person instead of being a good convict. And I wish that there had been more men like me around while I was serving that 14 years to try to help condition me It was just something I didn't realize happened, and I didn't mean for it to happen. And yeah. I genuinely regret it every day. So.
Yeah, it's a very hard, it's a very difficult thing to evolve on your own, particularly when the harsher and the more anti or unevolved or devolved the atmosphere is. Have you heard of learned helplessness?
Learned helplessness. No, yes. I actually haven't heard of that.
It's a thing that they've proved, at least in a college situation, it can be taught in the space of a half an hour. You can convince somebody that they're dumb, that they're not good enough. They gave two different groups of people a page full of anagrams, and they told them all they were easy to solve, they should be done in 5 minutes. Well, half of the room had easy to solve anagrams. The other half had impossible anagrams. And they get, at 5 minutes, all the people that had impossible ones kept watching people raising their hands and turning in their work, and they weren't able to get one. And they started to feel like, you know, maybe there's something wrong with me. By the third test, they didn't even try. Most of them didn't even bother to try. All in the space of one class. So we know when you get the messaging that you're not good enough, that you're stained, that you're, you know, treated less than human. This is something. But fortunately, like you were saying, if you have more people who want to be good people and can come to the, I don't know how, without assistance, but miraculously come to realize the resources inside themselves and the goodness that's there, the light that's there along with the darkness, it's also easily unlearned. But the longer you have it, of course, the steeper the climb.
Well, I appreciate you actually, in concept, that makes perfect sense to me. And you said it's called learned helplessness. I'm sure there must be studies or something on that. I might actually do some reading up on that. I like to try to broaden my mind.
You want to talk about reach?
Well, you know, Jack, after I'd been here for just a short couple of months, I had the benefit of connecting with a friend that I've been friends with since, I think, about 1995. And he's been in prison continuously the entire time. And while I went off and traveled the country in federal prison, he's been here in Washington State. His name's Kyle Johnson. He's just a tremendous influence. He's one of my closest confidants. And we were talking, and he said to me, he said, you know, if you don't start living your life, it's going to pass you by. And for me, at that point, I was 40 years old. I mean, it might have been 41. And I was on the wrong side of a 30-year sentence. And I was trying to figure out what life was going to look like to be that young and to be here until I was 60 and to know that I'll never have children, that I'll never be a homeowner. All of the things stripped away that really had only kind of been conceptual hopes, you know, not really things that were ever tangible to me, but still just part of the fabric of our world. And that's what Kyle said to me. He said, you know, you need to start living now or else life's going to pass you by. And I looked at him and I saw a man who was married, had been married for quite some time. Him and his wife were a beautiful love story. And I was like, you know, there must be some way to have a sense of fulfillment here now. And I got involved with something called Bridges to Hope, which is a program ran through the University of Washington, and it's sponsored by a professor there named Claudia Jensen. And every summer we do a class with a group of honor students. And here I was creeping up on the summer of 2016, and I was anxious, Jack. I've never, the last grade I completed in school was fifth grade. I'm going to skip to seventh grade. And I've never completed a grade since then. I mean, I've gotten my GED while I was in prison. I've taken some, you know, vocational training stuff. But working in a classroom was something I never, ever had an occasion for that resulted in success. Mm-hmm. So as the summer class for 2016 was coming along, I was focusing on trying to develop a reintegration skills class, sort of a release planning class here at the institution. I'm going to actually integrate into this the greatest thing that's happened in my life, which is meeting and falling in love with my wife, and then also explaining REACH.
Good.
And in preparation of that summer class, I was lucky enough to have the assistance of a sergeant here who was doing some research for me, looking things up on the internet. I was trying to find programs that work with and assist prisoners, et cetera. And as we were going through this, she came across something called adopted inmate. And I remember telling her, hey, wait a second, stop. I want to read that. What? Actually, you know what? Just mark it for print. I'll read it later. And I'll now return to that in a few minutes. But this, of course, adopted inmate is the most significant and momentous thing that's ever happened in my life, which you already know. So the summer class proceeded, and it ended too quickly. And we walked away from that with the knowledge that the local administration here really wasn't going to do anything, that we were almost screaming into a vacuum whenever we said, hey, look, we want to do something good. And as we moved away from that summer class, I found myself engaging a group of peers here within the institution who were all co-committed to changing our community, ourselves, and to building the programs necessary in order to do that. And with that motivation, with that desire, came the origins for something that's called the Reentry Empowerment and Community Health Program, REACH. Unfortunately, REACH, because it was, I think, modeled after aspirations and hopes more than practical application, REACH itself is now defunct. However, there are two operating parts. One is REACH Skills, which is a DOC program and is designed to walk a person through their last year of incarceration. What does that look like? What does the release process look like for getting your money and your ID and your whatever it is as you're literally walking out the front door? And then there's REACH Resources, which is the part that I focused on helping to build. And we've actually built it into a very robust peer-based reentry and release planning program. And what we do in the institution, there's, I think, 25 of us right now. We're in every housing unit. There's 4 units. And we do release planning with people in the institution. We sit down with them with an actual release plan, and we go through it, and we complete it. We help them build a support network and write that support network into the plan. Wow. And we help them connect with resources that they need in order to build that network. One of our greatest partners towards that goal is Interaction Transition, which is a Seattle nonprofit, which actually was founded by prisoners at McNeil Island in the 70s. So there's a long history of this, that of prison-driven or prisoner-driven desire for change. Once we get these guys with a completed release plan, Interaction Transition types it up so it's printed nicely off of a computer, and they can submit it to the parole board or to their counselor, to their CCO, oftentimes to their family, because some of the work we do, some of the most important work that we do with people planning to get out is family reunification and trying to rebuild the damage that criminal life and drug addiction, et cetera, has brought upon people. And a lot of times that's multi-generational, so it takes much work to really get to a point where we can say, okay, instead of trying to figure out who was wrong, let's just try to figure out how we move forward from a place of love and trust. Both things that are very difficult for people who have been subjected to the criminal justice system. So that's what REACH Resources does. We have worked with certainly close to 500 guys. I mean, we've done paperwork with somewhere around 400. We help them get their Social Security cards before they get out, birth certificates, driver's license manuals, just, and it's only getting better. Literally, it seems as if every week a new resource, a new relationship, a new partner is built that's from the community reaching out to reach into here and to support us in that work. I would add, Jack, that we've had a considerable amount of resistance from the prison staff and prison administration. And that part of that resistance is sort of systemic. It's contrary to their agenda, their overarching goal, to see people succeed, to get out and not come back. However, the other part of that resistance is I have flat out refused to allow REACH Resources to be a DOC program. We are a peer-driven program. We are a group of men who have declared that we intend to change the culture of prison. And that we intend to change the message that we teach each other in here to one that allows a person to come to prison for committing a crime and not leave prison as a criminal.
Right.
And we are the ones who have the greatest ability to impact that. And as prisoners, I say that we are the greatest asset that society has towards reducing recidivism, and nobody, almost nobody, wants to engage us and allow us to do that work. So I've refused DOC. I've rejected them many times where the power dynamic has become one that disempowered myself or the men. And today, we're very blessed and fortunate to have created a number of very strong community partners who are sponsoring us, like the Freedom Project in Seattle, Washington, and Interaction Transition. So it has been a struggle. It has been a real struggle.
Yeah, I'll bet. How early? I mean, who else is going to do it, you know, if you're not doing it for each other? The incentives just aren't aligned for the people who are part of the system, down to the guards, as far as I can see, for them to really want you to get a leg up. You know, it would defeat their entire ideation, their entire concept of who you are and why you're there. And also then would make them have to treat you differently, right? And to think of you differently.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you're able to do that, in spite of the messaging that they are giving you, which is denigrating, right? If you're able to succeed and help each other, the message is even that much more powerful, with the autonomy that you have.
You know, you had asked me about what sort of partnerships have developed in the work that I'm doing and the travels that it's taken me through. And I discussed it earlier. I talked about adopted inmates. And, you know, to me, it's, I guess I'm a sucker for a love story, and I'm probably that much more so for my own. And I still remember just calling their phone number. And this woman, who I didn't even know, her name was Melissa, she answered. And in the 20-minute call, I was so amazed at the work that they were doing and how organic it was. And honestly, it was a tragic story. Her brother had been arrested in Texas and sent to prison. It was the first exposure to the criminal justice system that anybody in their family had had. And early on, Melissa realized that virtually every time Rick called home, and the calls were very, very expensive, I think they were like $20 in county jail, there was always a list of people who were like, hey, will you please just send a text to this number and, you know, tell them I'm okay and I love them. You know, and to, you know, tell my son I love him. These, again, tragedies heaped upon tragedies. These were other people who were asking Rick to have Melissa pass on messages for them.
Okay.
And they realized, wow, there's so little positive quality, consistent, stable community support for people in jail and prison. And mind you, this was their very first exposure to the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you, Jack, that I have seen thousands of Ricks come through prison. The guy who came through prison who probably didn't belong there, and as it turns out, he was innocent of the crimes he was accused of. And their family kept them in comfort the entire time they were in prison. They always had the money to call home. They always had personal books, just all these different things that were always there that supported them through their prison experience. All the things that I never had until a few years ago.
Huh.
And in this case, instead of just doing that, instead of just supporting their single loved one, they actually decided to start a nonprofit. And to put this in numbers, there are 2.2 million people in prison in America, in jail and prison. And I think that's just prison, right? I think when we talk about jails, the number goes to 2.7 or something like that. They started a nonprofit designed to try to connect people who are incarcerated, regardless of what they're in prison for or the length of incarceration or even what state, with people in the community. And to me, that was the exact heartbeat of everything that I knew I had needed all the times before that I was getting out of prison. I never had anybody in the community I was connected to. And during the time that I was in prison, like federal prison, I went 11 and a half years without a visitor, without a hug, without a kiss. And I still today have not recovered from the pain of that. It was beyond description.
How the hell did you do it? How would you do it? I can't imagine.
You endure. You endure. And by the time I got off the phone with Melissa, I was so enthralled with this family who I didn't know anything about really at that time except for this bare basic stuff. And I remember I asked her if there was something I could do to help her. Later, as her and I started to become friends, as we started to talk, I remember asking her once if she was adopting me. And she told me, no, you're my friend. And I've never had as strong a response of trust towards another person in my entire life. And that trust has never wavered. And our phone calls became very consistent, very nightly. And then they built into morning and night and just about every chance we could. And we fell in love.
Yeah.
Her and I were married in November 11th of 2017. And I think that the most important thing about this is that when you commit yourself to doing good in this world, you're going to find other people who are co-committed to good. And for me, that's what happened. And that's how I met the person who is my soul friend.
Sweet.
And, you know, over the last, you know, over the 4 years that, you know, 4.5 years that I've had the pleasure of being a part of their life, adopted inmate has grown dramatically. There's, I think, 8,000 or 10,000 people across the country that are in the database. Yeah, they've got thousands of surveys sent in from prisoners that haven't even been entered yet. And Melissa does all this from home while being the primary caregiver for her aunt that has dementia and had a stroke, while still maintaining, you know, relationships with her children and her grandchildren, and a healthy relationship with her husband. She's honestly kind of a miracle walking in shoes, right? And her heart is just, you know, I've learned to love the world better through the love that she shares with me.
Yeah, going to the Adopt an Inmate website and browsing for a while is enlightening. It's such a beautiful. I'd be honest with you. I mean, I teared up just reading the story of her brother and the work that they've done. And you're right. It is so organic because they just began, I think, by writing to inmates.
Yeah.
And then calling.
And, you know, Jack, I'd love to share a story with you that I think is going to be very moving for you. I have a friend, and he was a prisoner. His name was John Wilson, and he was, you know, early 70s African-American man serving a life sentence in prison. And he was what's called a third strike offender. He had been sentenced to a life sentence for an unarmed robbery. And he'd been in prison 21 or 22 years, and he and I were friends. We became friends, I don't know, probably about 2014 or so. And I remember talking to him and encouraging him to consider petitioning for clemency. That's a process here in Washington where there's actually a board that reviews you, and if they recommend clemency, it goes to the governor to consider whether or not he will grant clemency or not. And at first, Mr. Wilson was very resistant to the idea of clemency. He found a lot of excuses. And then there came a day when he actually sent a letter to the King County prosecuting attorney. His name is Dan Satterberg. Wonderful guy. I have tremendous amount of respect for him. He's very active in working to try to reform this entire system. He is part of the solution from within.
Wow.
And Mr. Wilson was referred to a professor named Paul Holland at Seattle University, who represented Mr. Wilson for clemency. And Mr. Wilson, thankfully, was actually granted clemency, and he's a free man today in Seattle. The reason why I tell you about Mr. Wilson, not only because I think that's an amazing, wonderful story that my friend who now has gout and can hardly walk gets to be free instead of dying in a prison cell, but Mr. Wilson had went 21 years without a visitor until Adopt an Inmate connected him with one of the staff, and he was adopted. And Leah Patterson came to visit Mr. Wilson, and it was the first time in 21 years that he sat in a visiting room and drank soda and ate ice cream and food from the vending machine and had a hug and had somebody hold his hand and tell him that he was still a human that had value. 21 years of isolation. And I want to illustrate to you that throughout that time, he was a model prisoner. He was everything that a citizen should ever be, which is why he was granted clemency. But he spent that time alone and isolated and cut off from the world, which is exactly what my wife's program works to try to end, works to try to cure, because that is a tragedy. And my wife actually came and testified at Mr. Wilson's clemency hearing. Mm. She drove up from Oregon to Washington State, and she testified at his clemency hearing and committed adopt an inmate to assist him, to be there to offer him support and whatever assistance they might be able to or might need to offer him as he transitioned into a world that was completely unfamiliar to him.
Yeah.
And that's kind of stuff that you know, adopt an inmate does. And that's probably some of the most important things you'll ever do in this world, to touch a life that is that isolated and that lonely and touch it with love.
Yeah.
You know, she recently, a few months ago, we finally managed to get federal nonprofit status, which has opened some doors to a variety of different options for us. But to date, this is an unfunded program, and Melissa pays for everything. Literally everything out of her meager monthly paycheck. And anybody who's ever been paid by the government to be a caretaker knows that it's a meager paycheck. And, you know, the work that they do is just, it's indescribable, the impact that it can have and that it has had and that it will have. So.
Yeah, and it's unknowable how just even one of the people they've touched, how it will change their reentry into the world, way they behave in society, way they touch other people. Yeah. But 10,000 strong. That's an army of change. Incredible.
Well, I think to date they have a little over 1,000 adoptions. But they have
What does an adoption mean?
So adoption means that what happens is somebody in the community who wants to connect with somebody who's in prison, who wants to sponsor them, wants to try to help improve their world. And that doesn't necessarily mean through material support, although the bulk of the people in the database are from prison in Texas. And in Texas, the people in prison receive no wages for their work. They have no ability to have an income. And they're not given shower shoes. They're not given hygiene items. They're not given anything. And if there's nobody in the community to support them, then they do without. Or they're driven towards breaking the rules. I think that we wonder sometimes why so many people sell drugs in prison or tattoo or make alcohol that they sell to each other. But if you stop and consider that for places like Texas, for many, there's no other option except for to do things like that, where do we leave people who's ability to be self-sustaining can only happen upon criminal behavior? That's a horrible situation to put somebody in, particularly when we're supposed to be taking a corrective measure.
Right.
So adopting somebody doesn't necessitate material support, but it's encouraged that people consider, hey, what are the circumstances of my adoptee? So if I wanted to adopt, I would go to adoptaninmate.org and I would actually submit a request. And what would happen is probably in 6 weeks or so, Melissa will have an opportunity, her and her staff would have an opportunity to reach my name, and they would go through the database based upon the things that I've specified. Maybe I'm interested in, we get a lot of ethnic-specific adoptions. A lot of people really want to support and assist people of color, particularly younger people. And what would happen is I would be sent a list of potential adoptees. And it's not uncommon for an adopter to actually choose two or three people and then to begin emailing where possible or sending letters. Typically, this includes phone calls and books and just a positive connection in the world to let somebody know that it's really not helpless and hopeless. There's a reason to try to keep your head above water instead of just drowning in this horrible misery.
I'm absolutely sure that the good that it does for the person adopting is equal to or greater than what it does for the incarcerated. You may find that hard to believe, but I'm certain of it.
Well, actually, I don't, Jack. I got to tell you that I've learned the beauty of mutual support. I've learned how we all enrich each other's lives, just given an opportunity to do so. Adoption has many different degrees, and of course, everybody is always encouraged to adopt and approach with practical caution. That's not to presume that every person in prison is a monster, but instead to be cognizant of everything involved, which is the same as when you walk into a grocery store or you walk, if you're going out with some friends to a bar for a drink. Everybody should always approach every situation with a certain level of awareness as to what, you know, where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one thing that we are working to build into the Adopt an Inmate website is we're going to build a release planning toolkit for adopters. And that toolkit will be designed to assist adopters in navigating what release planning looks like. Because I don't care how long you're in prison, Jack, you're thinking about getting out of prison. And uniformly, our adopters tell us that their adoptees are anxious. And I can tell you from personal experience that when you discuss reentry, it's just a conversation about fear. Mm-hmm. And reentry is a fancy word to say fear. And our goal at all times should be to reduce fears to a healthy level and to increase confidence to the appropriate level. And we want adopters to be able to have some guidance because for many of them, they have no exposure to the criminal justice system, nor do they have any real understanding of the inadequacies in the infrastructure as it relates to helping people transition back to the community.
Mm.
Most people in society at this point, Jack, really feel as if state and federal governments, prison systems, et cetera, are doing their jobs, which is assisting people in transition back to the community and helping them find some place in a society that they've oftentimes been removed from for decades. And the stark and harsh reality is that's not true. People are released out of a front door, and they're given $40 here in Washington, and they're told to be at a certain place at a certain time or they'll get arrested. They have no experience with public transportation. They don't have Google Maps on a smartphone in hand, nothing. And the consequences are extreme. So when we talk about adoption, it's really just the level of commitment between each other, the adopter and the adoptee, that might develop as whatever rapport develops.
Mm-hmm.
Many times adopters contact adopt an inmate and say, hey, you know, this isn't really working out. This isn't a good fit for me. And then we work to try to adjust that and find somebody that might be a little bit better aligned for them.
So you're doing this work on the inside. You're doing the release planning features and working with people to reach resources and helping to get them to make sure that they have resources that they need, because they may have housing that may not be a need, but they may need clothing, they may need other things, and you help to figure that out for them and get them a sort of something that's modified to their own specifications. And how early do you begin doing that? How early before release can that start?
Well, I'm going to tell you, and this is a heartfelt response, a person should start planning to get out of prison the day that they get arrested.
Mm.
And I know that in some instances that's kind of a hard thing for a person to wrap their head around, but I assure you that the key here isn't just connecting people to resources, it's to trying to sustain something that resembles a healthy thought processing.
Uh-huh.
It's very easy to get lost in this. This is such an inherently negative environment that if you don't come into it with the desire to come out of it, a lot of times you'll leave the best parts of yourself in here. Practically speaking, a person should start really putting together their release plan, housing, employment agencies, options, clothing assistance. They should really start planning all that stuff 3 years before they get out. And they should start working to connect with organizations that provide support services local to whatever area they're going to. And I say 3 years because a lot of times it's difficult to gather the information, particularly when you're in prison. Information is valuable, but it's rarely given to us.
And if it's not something that Adopt an Inmate does, are there other organizations outside of prison that you can that help you bridge those needs for those resources?
You know, there are, depending on what part of the country that you're in, a very good resource for everybody to contact if they're trying to help somebody that they care about develop a plan to transition back to the community is Goodwill. Virtually every Goodwill has some sort of a post-release assistance program. There are other organizations that are in urban communities like Urban League. That's a very good one. Volunteers of America is a national program. So there are places and programs, but mind you, a lot of the people that are in prison don't have anybody in the community that will contact those places. And today, when a letter comes in from a prisoner, handwritten letters are just not the method of communication. Today, it's electronic communication. And I got to say that probably, if we're being generous, 8 out of 10 handwritten letters go unanswered, which really is something that these organizations could stand to improve on if they're really committed to trying to help people come out of prison.
Yeah, why is that? Why would they go unanswered?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Why? Why do they go unanswered?
You know, I think that there's probably several different things that factor into that, Jack. One of those things is in no small part, probably poorly communicated need. If a person writes and doesn't really know how to communicate what their need is, how much time does somebody necessarily have to try to sort that out? I would say that anybody who is involved, who's employed in an organization to provide services to assist people, that their chief commitment should at all times be to assist those people. And if that requires trying to discern something and take the time to maybe read a poorly constructed letter, because many people in here have education levels that make it difficult even to read their writing. That's just one consideration there. The other one is, I'll just be perfectly honest with you, is that I believe many of these organizations that have big names like I just named, hey, they're in it for the funding. I don't know that they're typically in it anymore to actually have the meaningful impact that they should be desiring to have. I say that because of how little impact that they have prior to people walking out of prison. We have this current, our release process is this two-stage pre-release, post-release process, Jack, and it didn't develop out of intelligent design. It developed out of necessity. Prisons felt like, oh my goodness, everybody expects us to at least send this guy out of here with a resume and a birth certificate, which they still rarely do. And then community organizations said, wow, we need to provide resources and support services for people as they come out. I think that in many ways, those organizations today have discovered that, man, this looks good, and they're all show and no go. I see very little impact on this side of the fence from organizations in the community. In Washington State, we're fortunate enough to have a volunteer program. And many of those volunteer programs, not like the largely named ones that I just discussed, but like Toastmasters Sponsors and Bridges to Hope and Interaction Transition and the Freedom Project, they come into these prisons and they connect with us. And then they work to help us provide those resources to each other. And that actually creates a continuum of care, because if we can connect people prior to release, we eliminate this two-stage release process and create a single continuum of care as a person transitions back to the community. But personally, I really think that it's incumbent upon those organizations, like the ones I named a few minutes ago, to create a more robust process for engaging people while they're in custody.
Right. Since this is Plague Talk, we do have to talk a little bit about COVID-19. So what have conditions been like at your facility under Lockdown Squared?
I got to tell you, Jack, they're pretty horrific. Our whole structure, the pulse of our life in here has just been really choked out. We are withering and we're dying, and it's not because COVID has made us sick. In fact, we haven't had any positive cases here within our prison. There have been positive cases at the Monroe Correctional Complex, but where I'm housed at Twin Rivers Unit, we haven't had any. I've seen instance after instance of farces, is that the best way? Multiple farces of being committed to trying to help prisoners not be exposed to COVID, because the fact of the matter is, it would have to come in from the outside.
Right.
Initially and early on, staff refused to wear masks. And I remember us arguing with them about why they weren't wearing masks. And I remember writing an article and saying, you know, when I would see the face of an officer unmasked, to me, I was looking at the face of an attempted murderer. And I was looking at a community that it is impossible to do any social distancing within. And they didn't care. Today, they actually do wear their masks, and I'm grateful for that. But as COVID developed and evolved and impacted our communities outside of prison, it forced a real dramatic and drastic additional isolation for those of us in prison. And by that, what I mean is that volunteer programs, religious programs, they were all stopped from coming within the prisons. Mm. Visitation stopped. It's just a horrible, horrible thing to be this isolated from people on the outside. It's devastating and brutal on our loved ones and our family and our friends.
Yeah.
And then in here we have these, again, I can't use the word farce strongly enough, but they do these things to, all of it's politicized. They have all these numbers on the DOC website that says how many people across the state are in quarantine and how many are in isolation. And they keep those numbers up for quarantine just so that they look good, because my wing, the section of the jail and of the prison that I'm in, has been on quarantine twice. It's 15 days each time.
Mm-hmm.
Never once has anybody tested positive. Nobody ever had symptoms. And we pretty much were allowed to have unfettered access, running around doing all the things that we were doing otherwise, except that DOC got to say we were on quarantine. Now, isolation was entirely different. And I will acknowledge that today they have repaired some of this isolation process. But Jack, I've got to tell you that initially for the first several months, the people that were being subjected to isolation literally were being subjected to some of the cruelest and most heinous treatment that I've ever heard of in prison. And to give you context, I've spent over 5 years in the hole here in Washington in the 90s. So I've endured a few things. And I've got to tell you that people came back from isolation just shattered. After 21 or 24 days without being able to shower and being put into cells that had recently been vacated from people who were believed to have COVID, and the bedding was still in there and piles of trash and stuff, and their refusal to provide them any kind of cleaning material, their inability to shower. Literally, a friend of mine...
Sounds like attempted murder.
Listen, that is exactly how he felt. And I have a friend named Jeff Strickland. And he's half tough. And when I say that to you, I mean that he's been around the block. He's done years in IMU. But when you go to the hole, and IMU, if you don't know what that is, it's the Intensive Management Unit. It's what they, it's the hole here in Washington State. And that's where the isolation unit is in the IMU. And typically, when a person who's experienced with going to the hole goes to the hole, we have a certain internal resilience because we kind of, I hope listeners won't be offended, we sort of adopt a fuck you type mentality. Mm-hmm. And that protects us. And that's how we endure, and that's how we make it through and come out the other side in some fashion.
Right.
Well, Jeff doesn't live that way anymore. And in fact, he's active in nonviolent communication, and he works with the Freedom Project. He is involved with Reach Resources, and he's a very powerful and important person in many people's lives, not the least of which is his own. And when they took him and they put him in IMU for isolation, this time he didn't go over there with a fuck you mentality. What he went over there with was an expectation that the world was going to treat him better because he was treating the world better. And they treated him so horribly and so heinously, literally. He threatened to kill himself and started cutting on his wrist with a little piece of plastic. And the officer said, "Let me know when you're bleeding and I'll come back."
Wow.
It was the most despicable treatment. And what it did was it actually sparked a full-fledged post-traumatic stress disorder attack for him. And he is still amidst that. He is still taking medication to help him with it. And I can't describe to you what it was like to watch my friend, who I thought was okay, right? Because I knew my friend went to the IMU, and I knew that my friend had years of that under his belt, and I knew that my friend could go over there for 2 or 3 weeks and he would be fine. And I was wrong. The whole time that I sat over here knowing my friend was okay, he was anything but okay. He wasn't permitted to have mail. He wasn't permitted to have a Bible. You're taking these people and putting them into an environment where they're potentially going to die, and they can't even read the Bible, with, if you choose to believe in that or not.
Mm-hmm.
No phone calls to their family, no legal mail, no access to legal materials. It was just absolutely a complete and utter abridgment of anything that looks like constitutional rights in this country. And
yeah.
It's despicable.
Yeah,
but
you may as well have been in Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, absolutely correct. And the funny thing is then they wondered why, they being the administration, wondered why people weren't self-reporting. Because we have people coming back here that are devastated from what you've done to them.
Right. Yeah.
They're not going to self-report. They're
sure.
not going to try to be a part of this. Yeah.
Right.
So it's just very, very awful. And today, you know, like I said, they've corrected the isolation process. I don't know why that makes it okay. In fact, it doesn't. It just makes it better. But we're still isolated from our families. We have video visitation through the JPay services, and it works like garbage. My wife and I have not had 5 minutes of talk time where we could look at each other through this little video thing and see each other and hear each other throughout this entire isolation, throughout this entire COVID shutdown.
How long has it been, though, since you've gotten to see your face?
They shut us down in early March. We went on shutdown in March.
Just, it sounds like a Russian doll of isolation, you know, and the one in IMU is just the black hole inside of the black hole.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because COVID lockdown is its own type of isolation, obviously, from the world, from the emissaries of hope that you were getting to see. I'm sorry to hear it.
Well, we're enduring. Unfortunately, it sounds as if maybe COVID is picking up momentum again, which means that we are going to start suffering again, further and further restrictions, more and more isolation from our friends and family and loved ones.
It's
difficult.
There's a lot of people who just don't seem to care about the consequences of their reckless behavior right now in society. And, you know, they've got some bad ideas that they're acting in good faith on those ideas, but the ideas themselves are just wreaking havoc on behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ideas about freedom and what it means, and, you know, conspiracy theories that the government is trying to control everybody by making them wear masks. And I'm sure that most of those people aren't even thinking with the kind of lucidity and largesse to imagine what might be happening to somebody who's incarcerated because of their behavior.
Well, I'll tell you, yeah. Jack, to be perfectly honest with you, we're a commodity to them. We're not people. We're not. Our human value really comes down to the amount of money that they make off of us, not anything to do with the way we think and feel, the way that our emotional range is continuously stunted and stomped down. Those things aren't what our value is measured by. Our value is measured by how much money will the government give every year to house us in prison. Regardless of what we've been in prison for, we are sent to prison as punishment, not for punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that our society, our country, it's a shame that as progressive and as successful, rather, how's that? As successful as we want the world to believe that we are, mm-hmm. We have this rate of incarceration so far beyond any other country in this world.
Greater than Russia.
All of the people that every person likes to get on TV and talk about, greater than North Korea, greater than China.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we have, America has 5% of the world's population, and we have 25% of its incarcerated population. And this really speaks to a systemic flaw. This speaks to this being an industry. And a few mm-hmm. years ago, I was fortunate enough, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to go on and on.
No, please.
But I was watching C-SPAN. And there's this woman named Danielle Sered. She's was a common justice director for the Vera Institute of Justice. And she said something so poignant and so true that it's always stayed with me. And I actually was blessed enough to exchange a couple of letters with her after that, because I made a point to try to connect with her and tell her that I was trying to change my world in here. And what she said, Jack, was that prison in America is the only industry that bases its expansions on its failures. That if she ran an automobile repair shop and you brought your car to her and got it back in worse condition than you took it to her, you would go out of business.
Mm-hmm.
But in America, the prison industry sends people back to the community worse than they came in.
Yeah.
And that is the balance that they use, the measuring stick, to expand, to build more prisons, to create more jobs in this field. And honestly, it is a shame. It is a blight on America.
It's an extension of the idea of slavery. It really is. And it's a way to take away somebody's citizenship and their rights for life. Brand them, take it away, and make them a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. It's terrific. I double over sometimes, like from the gut punch of the schizzy frame of mind of this country. It can claim to be Christian, forget that very simple principle, a couple of them. One is love your neighbor as yourself, but another one is let he who is without sin cast the first stone.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's coincidental that you're there and I'm not. I have driven drunk hundreds of times in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I have gone to somebody's home with the intent of killing them, and they weren't there when I was much younger. I had rage problems. All of these things, it's just inches or millimeters of difference. And also, you know, that I could have just been in the wrong place at the wrong time, been falsely accused. And short of DNA evidence, like programs like the Innocence Project, yeah, are proving to us over and over again how many people are incarcerated who've done nothing. But say you've done it.
Yeah.
Say you've done the thing. To take away the idea that you're human based on the fact that you've been caught having committed a crime, but so many other people have committed and not being caught, and that then you are that thing for life. It's based upon what is probably the very worst moment of your life. It's going to haunt you forever anyway. And then to take you in, take away your rights, take away your humanity, day and night give you the message that you're not worth humane treatment, that you're going to fail. And then, like you say, give you $40, and if you're lucky, your birth certificate, and say, now report to this office and don't come back. Of course!
Yeah.
All of the wheels have been greased to bring you right back. Yeah.
And I guess the one group that I would add to that, Jack, sadly, is all of the juveniles that were sentenced to life in prison. Fortunately, Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative have done tremendous work in that field and in that area, and have gotten the United States Supreme Court to strike down those life sentences. However, there are many ways around that for states. And
mm-hmm.
those ways in this state look like what they do is, well, we're not going to give you a life sentence. We're going to give you 4 consecutive 25-year sentences. And you can get paroled from those. And the United States Supreme Court doesn't revisit this issue. They leave it to the states, and that's fine. And practically speaking, nobody is going to live 80 years, Jack. They're just not. Not if you came to prison when you were 15. You might, mm-hmm. I suppose, but it's not a life sentence. So therefore, it doesn't run afoul of the United States Supreme Court opinion, and people are still left languishing in jail and prison for crimes that they committed as a child.
Right. It's insane. You really do need a great awakening about this whole system.
I want to tell you how much I appreciate what you're doing, Jack, the time and effort and energy that you're putting into it. And I know that your interest, and I know that your commitment may be distinguished from some people, but I also know that the number of people with your level of interest and commitment are also growing. And I know that we're having a raised awareness at this time in our country as to the way that our system, the policing system, impacts people of color. I think that people know unequivocally today that the prisons in America directly relate to slavery. And it was a transition from slavery to prison.
Yeah.
And today we also have this unique opportunity for everybody to push the envelope and to demand that people not ignore any more of the travesties or tragedies. And I would ask that listeners, you and your friends and colleagues, when people discuss policing and people of color and communities that are impacted by the criminal justice system, I would ask that people remember to please include in that conversation those that have already been sentenced to prison, those that have lost a voice, those that are incarcerated and have no way to try to connect with the community to say, hey, something awful has happened to me and I need help.
Mm.
I would just love to say that, and this isn't, I'm not soliciting, however, if anybody was interested in trying to contact me to discuss anything that I've talked about today or to ask and answer questions. My name is Jacob Ivan Schmidt, standard spelling, and I'm the only Jacob Ivan Schmidt on Facebook. So feel free to reach out to me, and my wife will assist in facilitating communication.
And if you have Melissa email me, or if you can, any links that you want up, anywhere, any way that they can donate to, of course I can find that out, but to adopt an inmate, anything that you would like brought to their attention, any informational sites, anything that you think you'd like to up with this episode, just let me know and we'll put them up.
Thank you so much, Jack. I appreciate you.
You're an inspiration to me. You really are. You know, it's things feel tough out here sometimes, but I look at what you're doing and the turnabout that you've made against all odds, you know, really, against all of the machine that's there to eat you, to spit you back out, but not too far away from the event horizon of the black hole and then draw you right back in. It gives me great hope. And you're right, this is a time where people do seem to be awakening. And the problem is that there are so many inhumane things going on. There's so many systemic problems. But this is a gigantic one. If we can, all of those who care, you know, all of those who might care become more aware of it. And I think altogether, we can affect more than just an incremental change.
We have 60 seconds remaining.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you, Jack.
Thank you for the time. We'll be in touch again.
Yeah, please don't be a stranger.
No. This is the beginning.
Fantastic. Have a good evening.
You too. Hang in there. Thank you.
I just want to let you all know that I interviewed Jacob this past Wednesday, July 15th, and though he never mentioned it before, during, or after our recorded conversation, he was taken on Thursday evening to a hospital in shackles for cervical fusion surgery. In the hospital, he'll be chained to his bed, and there will be two armed guards at his door. The procedure took place, presumably, yesterday. I say presumably because his family and friends were left in a communication blackout once the transfer began. He couldn't call them, and nobody would tell them anything. You might be able to imagine what a hell this is for all of them. Next week, our guest will be Melissa Schmidt. Melissa is the CEO of Adopt an Inmate and Jacob's wife. It's only through the efforts of Melissa's friend who works in that hospital that she was able to learn that the surgery had been successful, and that today Jacob is sitting up, eating, and will be released back to the medical floor of his institution tomorrow or Monday. I'm sure it would make his day if some of you went to his Facebook page, that's Jacob Ivan Schmidt, and left him a message of encouragement. I'll certainly be grateful for the gesture. If you'd like to be a guest on Plague Talk, or you know somebody who would be a great interview, please contact me through email at jack@plaguetalkpodcast.com, or through the Facebook Plague Talk page, or by using the contract form at plaguetalkpodcast.com. Send pictures of yourself or the lockdown gallery in your work-at-home spaces, and of your fun and joyful moments. If you have ideas for safe and responsible services for those sheltering in place, please post them to our Facebook page or email them to me. And if you know of links to critical helplines, services, support groups, and resources, we'd love to add them to our Smart Links page. Finally, if you can think of anybody you know who's out there sheltering at home alone, please find it in your heart and now more leisurely schedule to reach out and let them know you're thinking about them. Until next time, stay safe. Keep your distance, don't touch your mask or face, wash those hands, and stay at home, but let the world hear your voice. You've got something to say, we want to hear it. Plague Talk is a brainchild of Smarty Pod, theme music by Kiyoshi Fujioka.